From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The question that got Jennifer Senior thinking was this. What is the effect of parenthood on the parents? Not the kids, which is usually the question that's asked, but the grown-ups. And the answer is complicated, naturally. In fact, she wrote a book about it. But one of the things she found is that of all the things being a parent does for us, it doesn't necessarily make us happy. In fact, in some cases, it makes us considerably less happy. I guess it's obvious to say kids reshape our lives, but in her book, Senior explains how. Over the last 50 years or so, the role of mothers and fathers has changed because the role of children has changed. Jennifer Senior will join us today to explain this paradox of modern parenthood after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's this kind of awkward reality at the center of Jennifer Senior's new book. Turns out, parents are not really happier than non-parents, which seems obvious if you're one of those people who chose not to have kids, right? But over the years, the social science seems to have confirmed it, that children can make us miserable sometimes and tired. They can weaken our marriages. They can compromise our psychological health. But Senior wanted to figure out why, what it is about the experience of parenthood that today's parents find so challenging. And part of the answer is the kids, of course. The role of children has changed, but so has the role of the parent. Senior points out her book is not about the children. It's about the parents. It's called All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. And today in the program, she's joining us to talk about it. Jennifer Senior is a contributing editor at New York Magazine. All Joy, No Fun is her first book. She lives in New York City, but she's on a book tour, so she's joining us from San Francisco, from the studios of NPR member station KQED there. And Jennifer Senior, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I guess let's start with the idea that first comes into your head, because you kind of pinpoint it as January 3rd, 2008.
Yes, that would be the day that my son was born. Although I didn't start thinking about this question then, I should point out.
Oh, you didn't?
No.
You had other things on your mind.
An unexpected C-section means you have almost nothing on your mind. Oh, You're out of your mind with morphine, sadly. But I will tell you, no, truly, I actually learned about this body of social science that you referred to that suggests that kids don't improve their parents' happiness. I learned about that well before becoming a parent. And when I read about it, I was kind of incredulous, and all I wanted in life at that point was a kid.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I would have written about it and thought about it right then and there, but I knew no one would trust me as a narrator to think about this question and to really aggressively interrogate it until after I had become a mother.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. You talk about how no matter how together we are, you know, even the type A people, even the really organized, you know, we all know them. But there's not much we can really do to prepare ourselves for having kids because it's such a dramatic change. You write about this. This is an important thing to keep in mind, I think, because, you know, there's nothing you can do to really prepare for all of this.
Right. I mean, unlike, say, a job where you might you know, I don't know, if you're a doctor, you're probably going to go to med school, even if you, you know, don't do anything as rigorous as, say, the law or, you know, medicine. You're going to spend some time, you know, I think, on the ground learning how to do things. You date before you marry, generally. So, yeah, this is one of the few things where it's very hard to get a lot of practice, particularly now, because families are so small that it's not like as we were all growing up, we were all taking care of zillions of siblings and cousins. You know, our families have been small for quite some time now. So, and also, just to point out, too, we've been deferring child rearing if we are college educated. So the middle class, the average middle class woman has gone to college. Her age of at first birth is likely to be 30.3. So she's had tons of time on her own, leading this kind of freewheeling existence, doing all sorts of stuff that probably didn't include a lot of babysitting.
Right. You know, it's interesting. I was surprised at some of the studies that you write about that came from the late 50s and the 60s, you know, a time when I figured we were kind of in this bubble about the nuclear family. There's this, the work of a woman named Alice Rossi that you write about. She publishes this paper in the late 1968, I think it was, is, which where she talks about how abrupt it is when you add a baby into the equation for a couple. And you talk about how radical an observation it was for that time.
It totally was, and I think it's probably not an accident that she went on to be one of the founders of the National Organization for Women.
Yeah.
I think that what interested her was, and by the way, I think she is the only one who ever framed the question the way I do in the whole book, which is, how do kids affect their parents?
Yeah.
She wasn't really talking about their parents. She was talking about mothers, because I think in 1968, she was looking around and she was saying, look at all these women who've gone to college and are now at home. And I think she was in sort of Betty Friedan's territory with the feminine mystique.
Yeah.
I think she was looking around and saying, this seems to have put the brakes on some women's careers. And I think that some women are probably suffering from this. I don't think she had any objection to women staying at home, but I think that she noticed that there was this big derailment in some cases for women who were expecting to keep going and couldn't find a kind of plausible infrastructure for both work and raising children. Mm. And so she was very interested in that question and also interested in the effect on marriages and things like that.
Another report that surprised me came in 1957 called Parenthood as Crisis.
Yeah.
And it came to these conclusions that you mentioned in the book kind of transformed our ideas about what a baby does to a marriage.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites. So it's probably not an accident that the first paper that really ever looked at this question, because it was in the 1950s, that it was going to be looking at how babies affected marriage. This is like the peak time of, you know, the veneration of the nuclear family.
Yeah.
We're right in the middle of the 50s. So they weren't looking at the baby's effect on individuals yet. They were looking at couples. And nevertheless, my favorite quote from that paper is one woman saying that she knew what babies were, but she didn't really know what they were like, which I just thought was kind of remarkable, possibly because it was so taboo back then to say, I mean, the family was sacrosanct. You could not say that, oh, my God, my life has been thrown into upheaval and I'm very, very tired. But what they were reporting is exactly what a lot of mommy blogs talk about very regularly now. You know, the women would say, I'm fat, I'm tired, I don't have any energy for my relationship with my husband, I can't get all this stuff done, you know, and the men would say, my marriage has gone down the tubes. And I mean, it was amazing what he had found. And he was really ostracized for it. This was a guy named E.E. LeMasters. Yeah. It was a very radical thing to have written. But it got the ball rolling.
Yeah.
And I think that the earlier studies in some ways were much more negative sounding than the ones than the subsequent studies, because those were really cries de coeur, you know, they were cries for, you know, from the heart. I think they were really kind of political documents disguised, not disguised as scholarship. They were scholarship, but, you know, there was a political underpinning.
Yeah. You know, the title of the book, of course, conveys kind of this central insight that children strain our everyday lives, as you put it, but they also deepen them. This is where we get the all joy and no fun part. And this is important to say. I mean, you know, the distinction which you write about, and we'll talk a little bit more about this later, but the difference between happiness and joy.
Yeah. I mean, I can talk about it now if you like. I mean,
sure.
It's one of my favorite distinctions. Yeah. I love what George Valiant, who is a psychiatrist who he runs the Grant Study at Harvard, which has looked at men over the course of their lives. He thinks about the arc of people's whole lives. He's really terrific. And he has written a lot about what joy means versus what fun means. He has really soul of a poet and a philosopher. And he put it to me like this. You know, fun is eating a Snickers bar. Fun is watching a great TV show. Fun is ephemeral. It is about instant gratification. It is focused on oneself. It is fleeting. Mm. Joy is something very, 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 very different. It involves another person. It means being deeply connected to that person. And it means having such a strong and magnificent connection to that person that there's almost something scary about it. His theory about joy is that it's harder to tolerate than sadness in some ways, because implicit in the idea of joy is this idea that you might lose this thing that you are so connected to. And it's unbearable to contemplate losing this thing, which explains why so many parents, you know, say react to Newtown or something. Every parent has had, and takes it personally, every parent has loved their kids so much that they are suddenly choked by the thought, oh my God, what would my life be like if I lost my kid? It would be unlivable. And I think that's the kind of just profound, awesome, in the religious sense, connection that Valiant was talking about.
So you spend some time in the book, and we'll come back to this, I think, but, you know, the fact that children, turns out, you know, don't really improve parents' happiness. In fact, there's kind of this net sort of zero effect. In some cases, there's a deficit. Sometimes they make us less happy. But what's really interesting is how it is that I'm not sure if it's this is exactly true, but it doesn't seem like it's always been this way, that this lack of happiness or a sense about all of this is kind of a function of modern parenthood. This is a really important part of the book. Talk about that part.
Absolutely. I think one can't really say what the effect of children were on parents' affects 100 years ago, because no social scientists were doing studies like of the sort that they are now.
Yeah.
So it's hard to stipulate exactly, you know, how our core affect as parents have changed. I also do want to make one thing clear. The most recent social science is really interesting on this. The latest Gallup data has a much more nuanced finding, which is that parents experience more highs and more lows than non-parents. So we're simply recruiting from a larger emotional range. And I also, just to clarify, I don't want to suggest that there's no fun in parenting. Yeah. There's tons of fun in parenting. These are blunt statistical averages that surprise people. But everyone's individual experience is, of course, going to be different. So,
but isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting, though, the way that a lot of people are paying attention to the book, as if to say, aha, have you noticed that? I mean, I've noticed that a bit in terms of the kind of some of the reviews. The focus is often on this idea that parents aren't happy. And the book is so much more than that. But there's so much attention being paid to the fact that it's not fun and it's terrible, and we can acknowledge that.
Thank you for saying that. Yeah, it actually drives me really crazy. I'm collapsing in gratitude over here. You're just having noted that. I mean, and I'll tell you, I think that in part it's because everyone's really – in the way that people like to gossip, right? They like dwelling on the kind of dishy, taboo-y stuff, right? So it's kind of a dirty secret pleasure to talk about things that we can't talk about. And some of that is the parts of child rearing that are hard and that don't meet our expectations. But yeah, I try to give a much richer picture in my book than anything like that. But it tends to be that there's a lot of emphasis – in a lot of the discussions that I've had so far, and a lot of the pushback that I've seen online is, well, that's just crazy. That's depressing. You know, but no one actually reads the book when you're saying this, you know, which is much more affirming than that. Going back to your original question, which I really liked, I mean, I think there's something to keep in mind. I think before the 20th century, people didn't walk around with the expectation that they were supposed to be happy all the time. Yeah. This is one of the wackier, more consequential developments of, you know, kind of civilized living that we now, you know, are. If you are in an industrialized country and you can meet your basic needs, you are now expected also to be self-actualized and to be a happy person. And one of the things that we now expect of parenthood is that it will bring us happiness. And what's sort of been swept away is this idea that maybe what parenthood is about a sense of duty or obligation or service, and that one simply does it because that's what we've signed up to do, and that there's like tremendous fulfillment and nobility in that. And just to point something out, we now have so much flexibility. I mean, what Americans think of as freedom is basically, this is not my idea. This is an idea that was very beautifully articulated by the historian Stephanie Kuntz. Mm-hmm. She pointed out that we think of freedom as an exercise in subtraction, that it's a freedom from stuff, freedom from obligations. So we moderns can now walk away from our jobs. We can walk away from the town we grew up in and live somewhere else. We can walk away from our friends. We can walk away from our spouses. But you know what we can't walk away from? Our kids. Yeah. I mean, I suppose one could under the cruelest of circumstances, but it really is the last binding moral obligation that we all have. And so when people sit there and express disappointment that it doesn't make them happy, it might be useful to think about some of the time. I mean, obviously your kids make you happy a lot, but during the times when it's hard, it's kind of useful sometimes to remember, well, is that what you're in it for?
Yeah.
I mean, or are you in it for what's on your tombstone, which is that, you know, you raised three, you know, moral beings and productive beings. You know, you left the world a better place with these other people who are carrying on your legacy.
You write about, there's a woman named Jessie Thompson you write about from Minneapolis. And she has this thing, you go to this class and some of the stories, a lot of the stories from the book actually sort of come from this, flow from this class. And Jessie is talking to you, she has this kind of momentary feeling where she kind of confesses to you that she gets it, how some people would want to run away from their kids. And you write about how she's craving, as you put it, some of the old perks, the time before she was a parent, of being able to do what you want. But you write about how what a parent wanted, you know, has been kind of, as you say in the book, beside the point for most of human history. I think this is what you were getting at right there before, that the 20th century changed and human happiness is something that now matters. It's different the way we think about it.
It is. And in fact, Jessie said at one point in that class, what you're referring to is there's this huge program in Minnesota called the Early Childhood Family Education Program that 90,000 parents pass through every year if they've got kids between the ages of 0 and 5, or maybe 6 because it goes, you know, they can be up to kindergarten. So she was in one of these classes and she was terrific. But yeah, she essentially what she was talking about was she blamed Oprah at one point. She said, you know, she's made me think I have to be happy all the time. Yeah. And everything is about pursuing your bliss. And, you know, I just have to remember, you know, that's not what this is. But Jessie was a great example because until she was 32, she had this wild, terrific life. Mm-hmm. Like she was an airline stewardess or flight attendant, I guess they call them now, for a while. She was a bartender in England. Then she had a career in advertising. She was really doing lots of fun stuff. And then between the ages of 32 and 37, she had 3 kids right in a row. Mm-hmm. So I caught her at 37 years old with 3 kids who were like under the age of 5, which was a very intense change for her. And there was a really exquisite sense of like the difference between the before and the after. And she just every once and again would indulge in this fantasy of what it would be like to just have an hour back to herself. And I was reminded of this great line that Irma Bombeck wrote when she said that, I haven't been alone in the bathroom since October. I mean, that's, you know, can you imagine you're 32 years old, you've had this great life, and then suddenly, you know, you're not alone in the bathroom anymore. There's always somebody scratching at the door.
Yeah, which reveals one of these sort of facts that parents are putting off the time that they have their kids because they want to pursue that. I guess in some ways they know things are going to change, so they get it all in and have kids a little bit later.
Yeah, it's the capstone now to a middle-class life.
Right.
It's not like one of the first things you do, which is what the way that my parents did it.
Yeah.
Now you graduate from college, you find your job, you establish yourself in your career, you find your spouse, you marry, you buy your house, and then you have a kid. Mm. So just simply by virtue of it being last, in order. Again, this is if you're part of the middle class and if you had a college education. You're staking a lot on that. You have a lot riding on that. It's not unlike the way heroines in Jane Austen novels thought about marriage. It was supposed to be the be-all, end-all, this thing that you worked, that you spent your whole life waiting for.
There's this essay you referred to in the book by a writer, Adam Phillips, where he's making all these parallels between children and madmen. And it's in this section where you talk about sleep, how sleep-deprived parents are. But you write about how kids don't get that, you know, this idea that they're madmen. And this is why you say parents feel powerless, is because we get that kids are supposed to be, you know, jerks sometimes, and they kind of test boundaries. And Phillips puts it this way. He says, it's painful for a parent to have to frustrate your child.
That was such a moving sentence to read. I mean, there is a biological or a neurological explanation for this, right. I should say, which is that, you know, I mean, kids, really small kids, toddlers and preschoolers, their neurocircuitry completely conspires against an adult's in the sense that they have almost no prefrontal cortex of which to speak. Mm. And the prefrontal cortex is in charge of planning and in charge of impulse control and, you know, reasoning. And so, yeah, if you don't have that, your behavior is going to look a little bit mad, like you're kind of an uncorked id, you know, that you are just kind of hostage to your desires and to the things that interest you. So little kids don't care if their parents are telling them to put on their shoes, you know, that they're interested in whatever they're interested in. You know, they're designed to sweep in lots of stimuli and take in the world. But their parents live in the present, yeah, in the here and now, and they might have to get their kids out the door to school, and they make, you know, to preschool, let's say, or to do something, to run an errand. So parents are constantly in this position of like trying to reason with their children. When if their kids are 18 months or 2 years or 2.5 years old, they have no capacity to reason. And, you know, a professor in Minnesota, from that program, once made his class really laugh by saying, look, no 3-year-old is ever going to look at you and go, oh, yeah, Mom, that's a really good point. You know, like it's not going to happen.
Jennifer Senior is with us. Her book is called All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. We're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the journalist Jennifer Senior is with us to break down this basic question. What are the effects of children on their parents? You don't often hear it put just that way. Usually it's the other way around. What are the effects of parents on the kids? But Senior has written a book that explores how kids reshape the lives of their folks, their marriages, their jobs, their health, even their self-identity. Modern parenting is different because the role of kids is different. So is the role of parents, of course. The book is called All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. So you mentioned in the book how, you know, we hear a lot about overscheduled kids, but we don't often hear about what kind of harm all of this does to the parents. Again, you focus on the parents. So the overscheduled kid, what is the effect that it's having on the parents?
I think it's making them very stressed out. I mean, I think what people do is they say, well, those kids would not be overscheduled if the parents weren't overscheduling them. And to some degree, that's true. But I think you have to consider the forces that are making parents overschedule their children. And I don't think that parents, given their druthers, would do it. I think that they are feeling immense pressure to do it for a variety of reasons, which I'd be delighted to get into. But, I mean, the bottom line is that parents are now spending more time with their children than they did – mothers, I should say, than mothers did in the 1960s when they stayed home in the main. So you have to consider that what all this overscheduling amounts to is not only like a carpool Hades for the mom and dad who are doing the driving, but also you have to think about like what kind of ambient strains are running in the background and whipping through these parents' heads that are making them go to these very elaborate lengths, because often they're doing these activities along with their kids. You know, they're doing the Suzuki and violin. They're learning all the math and checking all the homework. They're going into Kumon and learning how these tutoring practices are, you know, being kind of played out. I mean, yeah, go on. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's amazing. But you point out we haven't always been this way. And so I want to talk about some of those forces, because you say, talk about what it was like say, before the 19th century for kids and for parents, because parents haven't always been terribly sentimental about their kids.
Exactly. I mean, this is what's so funny. I mean, there was a time, if you go far enough back, where children were just considered kind of small, morally defective adults. You know, I mean, and if you read like the sermons of Cotton Mather, I mean, they're very, very scary and take a very dim view of children. Gradually, children were sentimentalized. But the thing is, parents had to have a lot of them because obviously many of them died, you know, in early childhood. And more important, kids had an economic function in the family. So until really the Progressive Era, so let's say 1890 to 1920, kids worked. And they often, if they were boys, they would often earn more money than their fathers did, even. So this is not a moral arrangement. I am not in any way pining for the Dickensian days of yore when kids were capital assets. But there was something economically rational, at least, about the family. Mm-hmm. One can't say that now. So what's happened is that there's this wonderful sociologist who coined this phrase. She said that after the Progressive Era, what started to happen was that kids became economically useless but emotionally priceless.
Yeah.
And what that meant is, okay, so now kids don't have an economic function anymore. Thank God they don't. They shouldn't be working. But what is their new work? Mm-hmm. Their new work is homework. And they're now assigned more and more of it to prepare for a globalizing, rapidly changing world. And parents feel like they have to stay on top of that because the middle class is shrinking and they want to make sure that their children have a toehold in that world. What else is a child's work? Well, it's to go to soccer practice, because maybe if they learn a team sport, that will be a valuable skill. They'll know teamwork. Or it's to take violin lessons, because then they'll be excellent at something and then they can get into a good college because they're excellent. And if they get to a good college, they stand a better chance of, you know, maintaining a middle class life. Their new work is chess lessons. Who knows? Maybe that'll help. You know, that's good for analytical skills, or coding, or learning Mandarin, or whatever it is that is currently driving a parent crazy. These are all things that the parents have to sign up the kid to do. That's their new work, and it's become our work to get them there. And that's really different, you know. And their work is no longer for the sake of the family or even the broader world. It's for their own sake. And parents are really working hard to do that for their kids. It's a lot of effort.
It's interesting because you mentioned, so this is the kind of the rise of what you refer to as the, or what is referred to as kind of the useless child. And it's Steve. You mentioned Stephen Mintz, who wrote that book Huck's Raft, about it, how the changing role of childhood. But he mentions how from the moment children stopped working for adults, everyone became confused about who was in charge. I mean, it's interesting because on one hand, you know, you giving kids leeway to question and argue. You mentioned that can be good in their lives, you know. But you say this attitude is not so good for the parents.
Right. Well, in the 1950s, William White, who I think is best known for having written The Organization Man, you know, the guy in the gray flannel suit, he called the United States a filiarchy, meaning that the kids ruled. They were the ones on the top of the heap, and that everybody took their cues from him. And he took a very dim view of this. And again, note it was 1950. It was post-war when the sheltered childhood really began and the education-focused childhood really began. And so eventually what started happening, and this is something that a sociologist named Annette LaRue writes a lot about in her book, Unequal Childhoods, she points out that what middle-class parents have started doing is encouraging their kids to ask questions, to challenge authority. You know, if a kid asks a question, the parent will respond with a question and not say with the good old-fashioned, because I said so. You know, that parents are very reluctant to rule by fiat and to say, look, families aren't democracies. I don't have to explain this decision to you. You know, that it's become kind of strange. It has become strangely democratic. Mm-hmm. What happens there is on the one hand, you could say, well, this gives middle class kids a sense that they can navigate big, powerful, scary institutions. They have a right to question everything. And they have the moxie to think that the world is theirs. The problem is that, as we all know, you grow up and the world is not yours. You know, you have a long way to go before, you know, you have any agency usually as an adult, and you have to put in time. So, yeah, I think there's some debate about, you know, where the middle ground is between saying, I told you so, and saying, what do you think of the fact that we're all going to the zoo? Because it gives your kid veto power.
Right. Like,
maybe you ought to just say, we're going to the zoo. You know, that's the plan.
Yeah. I love Sharon Bartlett. She's a great character in the book.
Yeah.
I want to have you talk about her. This was, you met her in this class. You mentioned how she said something that really struck you, really, really moved you. Talk about Sharon.
I can't. So many things about her moved me that I'm not sure which thing.
Well, sorry. She's talking about taking care of Cameron.
That she's in it for life?
Yeah.
And that it was her promise to life? Okay. So here's what Sharon is, this minor miracle of a human being. She's terrific. Sharon was a grandma. I saw her in one of these classes. She was older than everybody at the table by like a coefficient of two. She turned out she was 67 years old. And she kept referring to being the full-time caretaker for her 3-year-old grandson. And I didn't know what the story was. It turned out she had lost her daughter. Her daughter died. She had 3 kids, and actually her story is incredibly sad. She lost 2 of her kids. One was a much longer time ago. Her daughter had died 9 months after her son was born.
Right.
And it was now Sharon's duty and obligation to take care of him. She had a very different vision of what her retirement would look like.
Yeah.
And she had the stamina of only what a 67-year-old woman could muster. But she spoke with such beauty about, number one, what it meant to take on this obligation,
mm-hmm.
that it was her promise to do this, and that she couldn't be who she was if she didn't fulfill her set of earthly obligations. And she was a very religious person, but it was funny how she put it to me. She said she wasn't really big on God. She was big on Jesus. She thought Jesus was really a great role model for everybody, and she really believed in helping people who needed help. And that is what her new earthly obligation was
yeah.
to take care of this beautiful 3-year-old. And the things, you know, I could see how stressful it was for her. She wasn't getting enough sleep. When you're older, you don't get enough sleep anyway. But at the same time, I also spent a bunch of time with her. And there she would be, like, running through the water park with this 3-year-old, just as free as a bird, looking indistinguishable from a teenager in her bathing suit, racing through jets of water, laughing her head off as if someone had just said, hey, it's okay. You can forget about being 67 for a while. You can be 3 when you're with this
yeah.
kid. And it was gorgeous to behold, you know?
That's
lovely.
That's what I loved about that. I think it was my favorite section, really, in some way, because there's this image of her in the Manor Park splash pad. And because you say that you were, you know, you went and visited her and you knew all the social science stuff. So you were kind of worried about her, but you say that there are some things that social science doesn't capture all that well. And I guess that's the joy part of what you were saying.
Completely. I mean, she shed her 67-year-old skin. She was someone else. And I even quoted from this book, Immortality, by Milan Kundera, because there was a line in it, there was a scene in it in the very beginning that I have not been able to shake since I read it many years ago, which is about like an old woman at a swimming pool who waves very gaily to a lifeguard and has no sense at that moment that she's old. She just looked girlish. Mm-hmm. And Sharon looked exactly the same way when she was running around in the splash pad. She just didn't look 67 anymore. She looked ageless. And as opposed to that morning when I showed up at their house, she had not gotten her rest. She had this three-year-old dervish. Actually, he was not a dervish of a kid. He was a fairly calm boy as far as three-year-old boys go. But still, I mean, imagine the mismatch. You know, he wants to play trains and play ghost, and he's racing around the room with a towel on his head, pretending to be a ghoul. And, you know, she's saying, please just let me have my cup of coffee. And then, boom, we're at the splash pad. And she's excited about getting wet and getting her toes in the dirt.
Yeah. I want to have you read a section. This is from that part of the book. Because part of the essence of the joy in being a parent you write about is that our kids liberate us. These are the gifts that we get from kids. They help us get out of our heads, you say, help us feel, I think, rather than think. Read this section for us, will you?
I'd love to, and I'm so glad you asked me to, because it's one of my favorites also, so thank you. Young children may be grueling, young children may be vexing, and young children may bust and redraw the contours of their parents' professional and marital lives. But they bring joy, too. Everyone knows this, hence bundles of joy. But it's worth considering some of the reasons why. It's not just because they're soft and sweet and smell like perfection. They also create wormholes in time, transporting their mothers and fathers back to feelings and sensations they haven't had since they themselves were young. The dirty secret about adulthood is the sameness of it, its tireless adherence to routines and customs and norms. Small children may intensify this sense of repetition and rigidity by virtue of the new routines they establish, but they liberate their parents from their ruts, too. All of us crave liberation from those ruts. More to the point, all of us crave liberation from our adult selves, at least from time to time. I'm not just talking about the selves with public roles to play and daily obligations to meet. We can find relief from those people simply by going on vacation, or, for that matter, by pouring ourselves a stiff drink. I'm talking about the selves who live too much in their heads rather than in their bodies, who are burdened with too much knowledge about how the world works rather than excited by how it could work or should, who are afraid of being judged and not being loved. Most adults do not live in a world of forgiveness and unconditional love, unless, that is, they have small children. The most shameful part of adult life is how blinkered it makes us, how brittle and ungenerous in our judgments. It often takes a much bigger project to make adults look outward, to make them, quote, boundless and unwearied in giving, as the novelist and philosopher C.S. Lewis writes in The Four Loves. Young children can go a long way toward yanking grown-ups out of their silly preoccupations and cramped little mazes of self-interest, not just relieving their parents of their egos, but helping them aspire to something better.
Jennifer Senior, her book is called All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood, and we'll take another brief break. Back in a moment, you're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Jennifer Senior. We're talking about her book, All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. So you say in the book that there's this gap in the literature about taking your care of your kid in those adolescent years. We talk about it when they're little, but the adolescent years part, the teen part, is under-discussed, you say. Why do you figure that is?
Again, I really love the framing of your question. It's exactly right, and I've never had a chance to answer that. And I think it's really important that people understand there is a reason for this gap. It's really hard for, I think, adults, if you consider how much information you get about the difficulties of raising small kids, that this information tends to come from bloggers, let's say mom bloggers.
Yeah.
Now imagine that your kid is much older. Is a mother going to sit there and write about their kids being taken home at 4 a.m. by the police because they have been throwing eggs at the neighbor's house?
Yeah.
Probably not. Do you feel comfortable admitting that you have a kid who does that, even though, by the way, tons of kids do that, great kids do that,
yeah.
kids who go on to, you know, win Nobel Prizes, I'm sure, do that. But, you know, you're not going to feel comfortable talking about it because you're going to be afraid it's a reflection on your parenting.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to want to reveal who your kid is on that blog. In terms of scholarship, I think it's neglected for a different reason, which is that it's much easier to measure the effects of how kids affect their parents at the very start. You can just look at it once the buzzer has gone, you know, the gun's been fired and the game begins. And that's also, you have birth cohorts, everybody's born at the same time, you can look at everybody. By the time a child is in adolescence, there are so many things going on in a parent's life that trying to string apart all the different variables, like where the parent is in his career or her career, where the parent is in their marriage, with so many, you know, with their finances, there's so many things going on that trying to measure their mental health in the midst of all of that is really hard. There's no clear beforehand as there was when there was no baby to start with. Now it's just like a messy life in progress. So you have an absence of both kind of real academic data and also anecdotal data from, like, say, the blogosphere.
You know, you asked this really interesting question. Is it possible that adults experience adolescence differently from children? Because you talk about how for kids, you know, everyone sees the John Hughes films about angst-ridden teens. And
yeah.
It's like, but you talk about that as like, in some ways for kids, they're not really experiencing it like that. I mean, that's how John Hughes is experiencing it. And that's how he's writing it. But it's different for parents.
Yeah, I don't want to undersell. And, you know, I fear maybe I might have by accident in my book. I do not want to undersell the difficulties of the adolescent years for teenagers.
No,
I
right.
think that they can be hard.
Sure.
Yeah. And I don't mean to suggest that some kids aren't really suffering during those years. What I found interesting about one fellow's research, his name was Lawrence Steinberg, and he's kind of the guru on this. He studies both the adolescent brain and the effect of adolescence on their parents both. So he is one of the few people who's looked at this bidirectionally, you know, both from the point of view of the child and the grown-up. And he came to this wild conclusion that it seemed to resonate very profoundly with a lot of parents I spoke to, that in general, no matter how big the crisis is for a child to go through adolescence, it seems to be even bigger for the grown-up,
yeah.
which is fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, and he gave numbers on this. I think he said that something like 40% of all of his, you know, the people in his sample suffered, you know, pretty measurable declines in their well-being once their kids hit adolescence. And I can tell you some of the reasons why, if you like.
Yeah, absolutely. Remember. I think it's really fascinating.
Okay, so here is his essential hypothesis. And I have to say, once I read it and once we talked about it, I saw it everywhere. It was impossible not to view every adolescent parent of an adolescent through this prism.
Yeah.
His essential stipulation is this. So in the earlier years, I mean, between 6 to 12, it's a fairly tranquil period in parenting. Your kids still really adore you. They think you're great. You come home, they come bounding toward you. That's a lot of rocket fuel for you. And they also, they're pretty obedient in those years. It's not like the early years where, you know, everything is chaos and you're sleep deprived. They've started to learn how to listen and they're becoming really interesting. Then they become adolescents and they want to spend less time with you, which is developmentally perfectly appropriate. They might be very rejecting. They might be very contemptuous. They might be very hostile. Also on the continuum of things, perfectly normal. But what this means, even if you have a great adolescent who's actually nice to you, is that whatever the case is, they're spending way less time with you. And therefore, you are naked and alone on a raft. Everything about your life has been exposed. Previously, all that love and support you were getting from your adolescent was kind of providing you with this crucial fuel to go through life. Mm. I'm sorry, your pre-adolescent, you know, your 6 to 12-year-old, let's say, was providing you with this crucial fuel and positive reinforcement. Then your kid becomes more rejecting or starts to pull away, and you have to fall back on other resources. So now you're going, huh, my boss doesn't like me very much, and neither does my kid. That stinks. Like, who am I going to go to for positive reinforcement? Or, gosh, do I like my spouse? Because my kid's barely talking to me. And, oh, my God, it turns out my spouse isn't talking to me so much either. I never even really dealt with that because I could kind of blow it off. I had some other source of esteem. So once he said that, I was so blown away by it. And so his theory is that what it does is occasion this kind of midlife inventory taking where you go, wow, do I like my job? Do I like my friends? Do I like my hobbies? Do I like my spouse? And that frequently those are the questions that are running through the mind of a parent of an adolescent.
It's interesting, too, because he says it's like in some way he's saying that adolescence, that whole period basically breaks down the whole family structure. The whole family dynamic sort of crumbles. And so after all that, after you get through it, he talks about how you've got to realign, kind of renegotiate these rights and these structures, I guess.
Exactly, that the script you were using for years. I think what he was also thinking about is the fact that the period preceding it was pretty tranquil. It was pretty serene. I mean, there is a big disruption when the kid is born. I mean, again, everything is thrown into upheaval. Nothing about your life looks the same. And everything has to be rewritten. What you do during the day has to be rewritten. What your spouse does has to be rewritten. All the old scripts go out the window. But eventually, you settle into a groove in those kind of pleasant 6 to 12 years, what Freud called latency. But then suddenly, your kid is challenging you on everything. Most crucially, your own authority and how much say you have in what they do. And that can turn things topsy-turvy, particularly between you and your spouse. I mean, if at one moment you think your kid has a point, but your spouse doesn't think that your kid has a point, now you're in a triangle. I mean, or, you know, you're being recruited into some kind of weird power struggle where maybe it's you and your kid fighting against your spouse. I mean, it just things go kind of sideways and kerflooey, right?
Yeah.
So imagine this kind of liminal tension where you can't figure out if your kid is a grown-up or a child. And one minute they're very clearly one thing, and the next minute they're something else. And one minute your spouse is convinced that they're one thing, but you think that they're something else.
Yeah.
I saw that all the time. That was frequently how the fights between moms and dads seemed to break down.
Yeah.
Do I go soft on this kid or hard on this kid?
Right.
Do I treat them like they have a say or don't?
There's this paradox you write about in the book that our memories of our experiences with our kids are really much different from reality. This is the remembering self part you write about. I really like that. Talk about that if you would.
I really like it too. Thanks for bringing it up. So Daniel Kahneman, who essentially invented the field of behavioral economics, he's a psychologist at Princeton who won a Nobel Prize for having done this essentially. He coined the terms the experiencing self and the remembering self.
Right.
The experiencing self is the person who goes through life doing exactly what it does and feeling what it feels in real time. And moment to moment, in real time, parents probably experience more anxiety and more stress and maybe more boredom at times if their kids are young than non-parents. It seems to be stressful for them. And so the experiencing self might find life challenging. The remembering self for a parent thinks that parenthood was the greatest thing that they have ever done. If you ask the majority of adults, you know, if surveyed, if they have had kids, you ask them what the best thing is that they've done with their life, what they remember with the most fondness, they will mention their children. It occupies this very privileged place in their memory, having raised children or even forget about how, even if it's in progress, they will bring up memories of their children. So even things that were really difficult to live through, like, say, being up with your kid at 3 a.m, your kid's sick, you're rocking your kid's helpless, and all you want is for them to go to sleep and for you yourself to get some rest. But then, let's say 10 years hence, what do you do? you remember what it felt like to have their arms and their legs wrapped around you in that koala hug, like mm-hmm. you were the tree. Mm-hmm. And you remember the sense of those four limbs around you and how they smelled and how much they needed you and how much you were able to provide for them and that you could give them comfort. I mean, that's magic. That is a magic trick of our minds, and it's transcendent. And it's, to me, it's what the ball game is, you know? And yeah. and it's my takeaway in a way. It's like I try to now optimize my remembering self as a parent. I take pictures and I write down things my kid says so that I can like dip into them and remember all these awesome things.
Yeah. And they give us a shot at redemption, you say, too.
They do. They do. Kids do give us a shot at redemption. You know, we can be our worst selves with our kids, but we can also be our best selves. They make us aim really high. And the people who lead like some of the most productive lives often say that they are thinking about their kids when they are doing things, that unconsciously they or consciously they are walking around knowing that they are modeling what they are doing for their children. Which is, by the way, the exact opposite of what Freud said, which is that we do everything to please a ghost, right? We're pleasing our mom and our dad. And that's not, it turns out, what the most kind of generative, that's a psych word, but, you know, the most productive kind of adults do. They tend to think, my children are my audience. I got to make this count and stick and look good.
Jennifer Senior. The book is called All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. She joined us from the studios of NPR member station KQED in San Francisco. Jennifer, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you so much.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Taylor Almond, technical direction from Mike Anderson, the show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.